Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Greg Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist currently living in Caracas, who assesses the effects of a two-week national strike organized by opponents of populist Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, who reflects on government censorship and propaganda during the 1991 Persian Gulf War and his fear that history will repeat itself in any new conflict with Iraq. And author and commentator Dr. Earl Obari Hutchinson, who looks at the controversy surrounding the comments of Senate Majority Leader-designate Trent Lott and the legacy of racism within the Republican Party. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian Weekly reports that Florida Governor Jeb Bush has been instrumental in seeking the release of several anti-Castro exiles who have been convicted of terrorism. These revelations come in a new book titled Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana by investigative journalist Anne Louise Bardock. The book exposes the 20-year link between the Bush family and Miami's Cuban hardliners. Jeb Bush's association with extremist Cuban exiles began in 1984 when he ran the Dade County Republican Committee and hired Camilo Pedreira as finance chairman. The Cuban exile had been an intelligence officer under the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista in the late 1950s. Jeb Bush also used his influence to get his father, President Bush Sr., to intervene in the case of Orlando Bosch, a right-wing Cuban exile convicted of 30 terrorist acts against Cuba. Bosch has been charged with firing a rocket at a Polish ship bound for Havana, and along with another Cuban exile, Luis Posada Carriles, of masterminding the blowing up of a Cuban civilian airliner in 1976 that killed 73 people minutes after taking off from the airport in Barbados. Last July, Governor Bush nominated Raul Cantro, Batista's grandson, to the Florida Supreme Court, despite having an unimpressive legal resume. Yet, Cantro had acted as Bosch's spokesman and once called the convicted terrorist a Cuban patriot on Miami radio. Today, Orlando Bosch lives quite comfortably in Miami, protected by U.S. authorities. A stinging irony as the U.S. aggressively prosecutes a war against international terrorism. On Tuesday, December 2nd, approximately 2,000 Mexican peasant farmers blocked traffic in Mexico City to protest the expansion of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which will eliminate tariffs on major agricultural products in 2003. In Mexico's rural areas, where 75% of the population live in poverty, the NAFTA agreement has led to the loss of hundreds of thousands of acres of cultivated land. And about 15 million predominantly young Mexicans have fled the rural areas for Mexico's cities and the United States. Since NAFTA took effect in 1993, Mexico's farmers have experienced deepening poverty, which they say will worsen in January when the second phase of the NAFTA agreement is implemented, cutting import taxes on 21 farm products, including potatoes, wheat, apples, onions, coffee, and poultry. Farmers from 24 of Mexico's 32 states marched in the capital city and later outside the U.S. and French embassies, carrying signs that read, "The countryside can endure no more." With the Mexico City-based Grupo de Economistas y Asociados, Mariano Ruiz says the worst is yet to come in 2008, when agricultural tariffs on maize and beans are lifted. About 2.8 million Mexican farm families make their living from these products. Carrying a sign that read, "NAFTA equals death," one elderly farmer at the protest said, "I have nothing. I am here out of desperation because I am poorer than I have ever been." Last May, there were several alerts issued by Georgia environmental officials stating that the tap water was not safe to drink. In the midst of all the warnings, North Atlanta civic leader Gordon Curtain became alarmed when his water came out the color of rust with debris floating in it. Atlanta's drinking water was not supposed to reach this level of unhealthiness, but to avert a budget crisis in 1998, the city of Atlanta decided to privatize its drinking water system to United Water, division of Suez, the French company that operates in 130 nations. In recent months, service from United Water deteriorated to the point that fire hydrants were turned off for months and leaking water mains went unrepaired for weeks. According to Mother Jones magazine, things got so bad Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin gave the company a 90-day notice to fix the problems or face losing its $21 million a year contract. Critics of water privatization, like Public Citizen, see Atlanta as a test case of why water systems should remain in the public domain. Milwaukee also has turned over its sewage system to United Water in the late 90s, but a recent audit found sewage in local waterways, including Lake Michigan. Atlanta City Councilwoman Claire Muller said, "Water is the worst thing to privatize. It's what we need to live. This was a big mistake." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In organizing a two-week national strike, opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez have succeeded in crippling their nation's economy, but have thus far failed in their bid to force the populist leader to resign. Venezuela has been thrust into crisis since last April's botched coup attempt, where business leaders and their allies in the military briefly detained President Chavez before his supporters reinstalled the democratically elected leader. While the Bush administration openly welcomed the April coup, the White House has since been more careful in its recent public statements, owing to the fact that Venezuela supplies the U.S. with 14% of its crude oil. The Organization of American States Secretary General Cesar Gaviria has attempted to mediate the crisis by trying to bridge the gap between the opposition's demand for a national referendum this February with President Chavez's position that the Constitution does not allow for a referendum until August of next year. Meanwhile, the OAS has voted overwhelmingly to reject any future coup attempt in Venezuela or an alteration of that nation's constitution. 16 members of the U.S. Congress, joined by religious and labor organizations, recently sent President Bush a letter asking him to support democracy and the rule of law by opposing any move to oust Chavez by force. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Greg Wilpert, a sociologist and freelance journalist currently living in Caracas, who assesses the effects of the two-week national strike, popular support for President Chavez, and the fate of key reforms proposed by his government.
The two sides, that is the government here in Venezuela and its supporters, and then on the other side the opposition and its supporters, have been stuck in a deadlock for quite some time now. This past 2 weeks now there has been a general strike, or actually you can't really call it a general strike, so it's more of a partial general strike, since only certain sectors of society are participating in it. But the real problem is that the opposition has managed to convince the management and some of the administrative workers in the oil industry to participate in this strike. And this has severe consequences for a country such as Venezuela that depends entirely for its entire economic functioning on its oil industry. And so this has caused serious problems throughout the economy in terms of supply, in terms of income for the government. It's just wreaking serious damage to the economy here. And the government has basically said that it's going to try to retake control of the oil industry as soon as possible because it considers this an act of sabotage, what the opposition is doing. And in the meantime, there are negotiations going on between the government and the opposition, which are being mediated by the OAS General Secretary, who's been fighting a valiant battle trying to get these two sides to come to an agreement. But so far, there has been no progress. So it looks like a pretty sad Christmas here in Venezuela, actually.
There have been reports that there is much in the way of a scare about violence to come if things are not settled over a negotiating table quite soon.
Yes, there's definitely a possibility. People are getting more and more upset about what's happening, upset at the other side for not giving in. And so it's very possible that violence will erupt at any time. If this continues and if it does serious damage to, let's say, food supplies because of the lack of gasoline, that could cause an eruption of violence for sure.
Greg, I wondered if you would tell our listeners a little bit about the relative support that President Hugo Chavez has, because here in the U.S., the coverage is mostly skewed to those who oppose him.
Yes, Chavez has actually a lot of support, which is never shown, as far as I can tell, in the mainstream media. I mean, certainly not in the national media here, And I have tried to observe CNN and the big newspapers in the U.S., and they hardly ever mention the fact that, for example, a little over a week ago, there was a huge demonstration in support of Chavez, probably just as big as the anti-Chavez demonstration that happened this past weekend. And because they always report only on the anti-Chavez demonstrations, it looks like that Chavez doesn't enjoy any popular support, but that's simply not true. Chavez draws most of his popular support still from the poor, the vast majority of the poor, it seems, who make up the vast majority of the country. So even though polls say that his popularity has dropped to something like 30%, it is far from certain, I think, that this is really a true reflection of his support. My guess is that a lot of the polls actually don't really reach into the depths of the barrios, which go on and on here in the hills of Caracas and throughout the country. And it's very doubtful that the pollsters actually get into those areas. It's mostly the lighter-skinned upper middle class that opposes Chavez, and it's the poor, darker-skinned population that supports Chavez. And if you go to any of the demonstrations, this is so obvious. You immediately notice the difference in the way people dress and in their skin color, depending on which demonstration you're at. And, I mean, I'm not just talking a couple people. The vast, vast majority, I mean, as far as the eye can see in both cases, you'll see, you know, people basically of lighter-skinned middle class at the anti-demonstration and darker-skinned Chavistas at the pro-government demonstrations.
Is there a fear on the part of the middle and upper classes that they have to act now to oust Hugo Chavez, otherwise he will consolidate his control and make permanent many of the changes that they dislike, the economic changes that he has put in place?
Yes, exactly. Even though, actually, this is never mentioned as a reason for getting rid of him. However, it is pretty well known that in January of 2003, a number of laws that have already been passed become effective, and one of them is the land reform law, and the other one is the oil reform law. And both of these, the opposition wants to oppose by any means necessary, because the oil reform law would basically reform the whole oil industry and would allow a number of things that the opposition has been fighting against. For example, the opposition has been fighting for, in favor of privatization of the oil industry, and this new oil law would make that much more difficult. It would raise taxes on companies that are extracting oil in Venezuela. Of course, there's many in the opposition who are involved in that business. They're basically trying to prevent that law from coming into effect. The same thing with the land reform law. There's many, you know, very wealthy people in Venezuela who own huge tracts of land, and the new law would basically require that any land over 12,000 acres would be redistributed if it's idle land, idle agricultural land. And much of the land that the people here own is idle. So Chavez is trying to restart the agriculture and redistribute land here at the same time. And the opposition isn't interested in that at all.
That was Greg Wilpert, a former Fulbright scholar currently conducting research in Caracas. Read Wilpert's dispatches from Venezuela online at www.zmag.org. Since the White House campaign to make Iraq public enemy number one was launched this summer, the nation has been riveted on the Bush administration's charge that Saddam Hussein's alleged possession of weapons of mass destruction justify a new U.S. war against his nation. The corporate media welcomed the talk of war, creating news programs, elaborate logos, and theme music dedicated to the topic of a future conflict with Iraq. In reviewing the U.S. media's conduct during the 1991 Persian Gulf War under the first President Bush, John MacArthur, author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, examined the ways in which the White House at the time easily manipulated public opinion through the use of blatant propaganda with the eager collaboration of a compliant press corps. As President Bush's son George W. now plans a new war against Iraq, MacArthur finds the same brand of lies and half-truths are being employed to assemble national support for a preemptive strike against Baghdad that most of the world opposes. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, who discusses his fear that Pentagon censorship combined with a timid brand of corporate journalism will deprive the American people of the truth in any future war with Iraq.
I don't know whether people are aware of the fact that the press in 1991 was rounded up and placed into what they called pools of reporters to allegedly cover the war in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Iraq. And the pools were, by definition, a kind of preemptive censorship. In other words, once you agree to participate in the pools and play by the rules of the Pentagon and the White House, you were essentially guaranteed that you would see nothing and that there would be nothing worth censoring because no one got anywhere near any combat. Nobody saw any corpses. Nobody saw anything you would describe as battle. And this was by design because the Pentagon and the White House and their public relations experts had figured out from past conflicts, particularly Vietnam, that ugly pictures of dead soldiers and civilians upset people back home and might weaken morale. Some went so far as to say that the press lost Vietnam, which is preposterous, and even the most extreme hawks in Washington and in the military know that's nonsense. But they'll say it to get people riled up against the press. In any case, they said either you agree to the pool system or you get nothing. And the media, by and large, agreed to the pool system, and we got nothing. The only really good reporting on the Gulf War, the actual fighting, occurred 10 years later. Seymour Hersh finally broke a piece, or wrote a long, long piece in The New Yorker about General Barry McCaffrey's rampage after the ceasefire was declared, in which he killed thousands and thousands, untold thousands of Iraqi soldiers who were really just trying to flee back to Iraq. But we saw none of that at the time. The propaganda side of the war, which I detailed, was very sophisticated. The pièce de résistance was the baby incubator atrocity that never happened. The famous testimony by Naira, the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador, who no one knew was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to Washington, saying she'd seen babies pulled from incubators, left to die on the cold floor of Kuwait City hospitals so that the Iraqi army could loot the incubators. None of it ever happened. Not one incubator was looted, not one baby was killed in that manner, and it had a tremendous impact on public opinion and was very effective at changing the subject from oil and Middle East politics and so on and so forth to simply human rights, which is not an issue that the first Bush administration ever showed much interest in, and just as the second Bush administration has very little use for it.
The media's conduct since the Persian Gulf War, and maybe we could look at the most recent conflict in Afghanistan, the pool reports, the restrictions that the Pentagon placed on journalists, were they in evidence and pretty much following the old Bush administration model here in 2001?
Well, actually, it's gotten even worse because they didn't even bother to form the pools this time. The government has gotten so aggressive, and Rumsfeld particularly is so aggressive, that they mock the press. They mock the whole idea of open coverage of anything that they don't want covered. And as a result, we didn't even have the pool system invoked. We did have instances where American reporters tried to go into villages in Afghanistan after they'd been bombed by the United States. And one well-known case, the Washington Post reporter Doug Strzok was stopped at gunpoint by an American soldier who put an automatic weapon to his chest, and he just held him there and wouldn't let him into the village. And I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that this next war could be the first war, if it does occur, where an American soldier deliberately kills an American reporter. Although the American press has been pretty well trained and healed now so that they don't make much trouble.
What's your greatest fears about the media's position at the moment in terms of their capability of doing justice and covering a future war with Iraq? What's your biggest concern?
My concern is that they will do nothing. And it's almost a certainty that they will do nothing in this next war. Whatever images we get of combat will be from Al Jazeera or the BBC, I suppose, but probably from Al Jazeera. And that will be until the American Air Force bombs the Al Jazeera bureau in Baghdad the way we bombed it in Kabul. It's the same thing we did in Belgrade. We bombed the Serbian state television headquarters because they were broadcasting genuine images of the results of the bombing, which were turning up on American television. More and more we're going to have to subcontract our sort of First Amendment rights to know what's going on in a war to foreigners, because our press and our television networks just aren't going to do it. anymore. So my concern is more resignation now. Harper's will try to get somebody into Iraq, and we'll try to get somebody to report back the news, but we're a monthly, and that's not going to be immediately and urgently effective the way a daily newspaper or a television network can be.
That was John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, published by University of California Press. Visit Harper's Magazine website at www.harpers.org. Since Senate Majority Leader-designate Trent Lott stated his support for Strom Thurmond's 1948 run for the presidency on a segregationist platform at the senator's 100th birthday celebration, a political firestorm has erupted. After some delay, the media focused considerable attention on Mr. Lott's comments, which the Mississippi Republican has spent the past 2 weeks apologizing for. While President Bush used strong language to condemn Lott's words, he stopped short of asking him to step down as Majority Leader. But other powerful Republicans, some who are candid about their ambition to replace Lott, have openly questioned their colleague's ability to effectively preside over the Senate after the uproar. A vote of Senate Republicans to decide Mr. Lott's future is scheduled for January 6th. In a bizarre attempt to survive the scandal, Lott appeared on Black Entertainment Television on December 16th and spoke of his newly found support for affirmative action and the Martin Luther King holiday, both of which he has a long history of opposing. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and commentator Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, who looks at the controversy surrounding the comments of Trent Lott and the legacy of racism within the Republican Party.
The irony about all of it is the man that started all of this furor, Strom Thurmond, in a sense has had a bit of a racial epiphany over the years. The Strom Thurmond of the 1990s and 2002 was certainly not the same Strom Thurmond of 1948 that Lott, in a moment of real candor that he praised and touted and said was a great guy, and his election would have been a great thing for America. But, you know, over the years, you mentioned the Martin Luther King holiday that Trent Lott on BET, anyway, said it was a mistake and that he feels sorry about, and he's caused hurt about that vote and others. You know, Strom Thurmond basically voted for the Martin Luther King holiday. Strom Thurmond voted for some aspects of affirmative action in terms of federal contracting. Strom Thurmond did not vote to uphold tax credits for Bob Jones University. Strom Thurmond also was very clear that, you know, he supported voting rights extensions. All these things that Strom Thurmond supported, Trent Lott either opposed or supported. In the case of support, I meant the Bob Jones University, which is, of course, a school down in South Carolina that openly practices racial and religious and gender discrimination. So at some point, and it will come before January 6th, Trent Lott will no longer be Senate Majority Leader designate. It will be probably Mitch McConnell, Frist of Tennessee, Bill Frist, or Don Nichols of Oklahoma. We'll see a new Senate Majority Leader. Not so much any great concern that Trent Lott has irreparably damaged the party in terms of his racial views and his racial statements, but the bigger thing is he's irreparably damaged the party in terms of the agenda that the Bush administration and the Republican Party must get through the 108th Congress. Let's face it, there's still a number of things of unfinished business that the Republicans are trying to get through. For example, Homeland Security, there's still some things on that. The war on terrorism, not only deeper tax cuts, but permanently extending the 10-year, $1.36 trillion Bush tax cut plan. So think about it a minute. You've got all of these things on your plate, your political plate. You're trying to get through Congress. And yet you've got a Trent Lott there who's essentially a distraction, who is essentially always going to be drug up by the opposition anytime the Republicans and Bush brings up something in Congress. So they can't have it. They just simply can't have it. So with the Don Nichols in there, with the Mitch McConnell, with the Bill Frist, you would still have Trent Lott without Trent Lottism. And I think that would be the danger there, because then the agenda's still going to go forth. That's not going to change. The problem now is it would be very quiet. It would be very subtle. It would be, there would be no rancor. It would be behind closed doors, no attention paid to it, which makes it even more dangerous.
Dr. Hutchinson, I wanted to talk about the Southern strategy employed by Republicans, a way to divide whites from blacks and peel away the conservative South from the traditionally Democratic Southern states. Despite all this mess with Trent Lott, you think the Republicans will be changing that strategy, or is that going to be pretty safe and secure?
They can't change it. I mean, how could they change it? I mean, it's a strategy that's worked. And if it's been successful, why would you change it? The Southern strategy you're talking about usually goes like this. Do and say as little as possible on civil rights and civil liberties. Do not under any circumstances court and pander to the African-American vote in the South. And essentially be a party that is essentially a white man's party in the South. You've got to remember one thing. All the Republican Party is a Democratic Party with another name. And by that I mean the historic Democratic Party in the South. The party of the old Strom Thurmond, the party of George Wallace, the party of people like Bill Bow and Vardaman from Mississippi. These were the people historically that were the backbone of the Southern Democratic Party, or the Dixiecrats. And so what happened in the mid-60s when the Democratic Party, essentially under Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, began to essentially become a party that championed civil rights, all the civil rights bills, voting rights bills, and so forth. Then you saw the wholesale really flight or shift, a transformation of the white Democratic, white Southern Democratic Party into the white Southern Republican Party. Now, while you saw a shift on that side, what you saw on the other side was the Democratic Party taking on a bit of an egalitarian face in the South. Now, obviously, more women, more African Americans, more Latinos. That was not the historic constituency of the Southern Democratic Party. It was not even the historic constituency of the Republican Party, such as it was in the South. But nonetheless, each party changed its face in the South. So essentially what we have with the Republican Party is old wine and new bottles. 40 years ago, Trent Lott would have been a Democrat. There's no question he would have been among the most rabid, demagogic wing of the Southern Democratic Party. So now, basically, he's among the most rabid, demagogic wing of the Republican Party in the South, and not the Democratic Party. You know, again, labels have changed, names have changed, but essentially the game is still the same.
That was author and commentator Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Contact his group, the National Alliance for Positive Action, at area code 310-672-2542, or visit his website at www.thehutchinsonreport.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.